then tossed it into Boyd's lap and strode up and down the room while the professor read it. Finally, he stopped pacing and stood in front of his friend's chair, shaking a bony finger in the Virginian's face as if he had the whole fire-eating South there in the room. "You people of the South don't know what you are doing," he declared. "This country will be drenched in blood, and God only knows how it will end. It is all folly, madness, a crime against civilization. You people speak so lightly of war. You don't know what you're talking about. War is a terrible thing." He resumed his pacing, still talking. "You mistake, too, the people of the North. They are a peaceable people, but an earnest people, and they will fight, too. They are not going to let this country be destroyed without a mighty effort to save it. Besides, where are your men and appliances of war to contend against them? The North can make a steam engine, locomotive, or railway car. Hardly a yard of cloth or a pair of shoes can you make. You are rushing into war with one of the most powerful, ingeniously mechanical, and determined people on earth, right at your doors." Then he delivered a prophecy. "You are bound to fail. Only in your spirit and determination are you prepared for war. In all else, you are totally unprepared, with a bad cause to start with. At first you will make headway, but as your limited resources begin to fail, shut out from the markets of Europe as you will be, your cause will begin to wane. If your people will but stop and think, they must see that in the end you will surely fail." In February, he resigned from the academy and came north, stopping off in Washington to see his brother John, a senator, who took him for a visit with the president. It was late March by then. Lincoln was at his busiest, harried by office seekers and conflicting counsels on Sumter. When the senator introduced his brother as a competent witness just arrived from the South, Lincoln said, "Ah, how are they getting along down there?" "They think they are getting along swimmingly," Sherman told him. "They are preparing for war." "Oh, well," Lincoln said, "I guess we'll manage to keep house." Sherman left in disgust. In reply to his brother's plea that he stay and resume his military career, Sherman flung out against him and all politicians, "You have got things in a hell of a fix, and you may get them out as best you can." He went to St. Louis and accepted a position as head of a streetcar company. However, when Sumter was fired on, he returned to Washington, and after refusing a brigadier's commission, saying, to Lincoln's amazement, that he would rather work up to such rank, accepted command of one of the newly organized regiments of regulars. As he came down the White House steps, he met a West Point friend and fellow Ohioan, Irvin McDowell, wearing stars on his shoulder straps. "Hello, Sherman," McDowell said. "What did you ask for?" "A colonelcy." "What? You should have asked for a brigadier general's rank. You're just as fit for it as I am." "I know it," Sherman snapped. In his anguished tirade on Christmas Eve, comparing the resources of the two regions about to be at war, the waspish Ohio colonel had made a strong case, mostly within the bounds of truth. Yet he could have made a still stronger case, entirely within such bounds, by the use of statistics from the 1860 census. According to this, the southern population was 9 million, the northern 20 million. And in the disparity of available manpower for the armies, the odds were even longer, rising from better than 2 to 1 to almost 4 to 1. White males between the ages of 15 and 40 numbered 1,140,000 in the South, compared to 4,070,000 in the North, a difference mainly due to the fact that more than 3.5 million out of the total southern population were Negroes. While these, of course, would contribute to the overall strength, by service as agricultural workers and diggers of entrenchments, their value was about offset by the fact that the North would be open to immigration, particularly from Germany and Ireland, both of which would furnish men in considerable numbers, as well as by the additional fact that the Negroes themselves would constitute a recruitable body for the invaders. 186,017, nearly all of them Southern, were to enroll in the Northern armies before the finish. Sherman, however, had underrated the manufacturing capacity of the South. For the past decade, the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond had been building locomotives for domestic and foreign use, as well as projectiles and cannon for the U.S. Navy, and only the previous year a steam fire engine produced for the Russian government had been exhibited in the north before being shipped abroad. All the same, the colonel was mainly right. It was in just this field that the odds were longest. The north had 110,000 manufacturing establishments, the South, 18,000. 1,300,000 industrial workers compared to 110,000. Massachusetts alone producing over 60% more manufactured goods than the whole Confederacy, Pennsylvania nearly twice as much, and New York more than twice. Only in land area, and only then in a special sense, could the South, with its 11 states, outstatistic the 22 states of the North. 780,000 square miles as opposed to 670,000 in the area including Texas and the first tier of states west of the Mississippi. Yet this was a doubtful advantage at best, as might be seen by comparing the railway systems. The South had 9,000 miles, the North 22,000, in both cases about a mile of track to every 1,000 persons. The North, with better than double the mileage in an area somewhat smaller, was obviously better able to move and feed her armies. Statistically, therefore, Sherman had solid ground for his judgment. You are bound to fail. Yet wars were seldom begun or even waged according to statistics, nor were they always won on such a basis. The South had the proud example of the American Revolution, where the odds were even longer against those in rebellion. Now as then, she could reason, the nations of Europe, hungry for produce for their mills, would welcome the establishment of a new tariff-free market for their goods, as well as the crippling of a growing competitor. And now, among the nations offering aid, there would be not only France, as in the earlier War for Independence, but also the former adversary England, who was most powerful in just those directions where the Confederacy was statistically most weak. What was more, aside from the likelihood of foreign intervention, there were other advantages not listed in those tables dribbling decimals down the pages. Principal among these, in the Southern mind, at any rate, was the worth of the individual soldier. The Southerner, being accustomed to command under the plantation system as well as to the rigors of outdoor living and the use of horse and gun, would obviously make the superior trooper or infantryman or cannoneer. If the North took pride in her million-odd industrial workers, the South could not see it so. Pasty-faced mechanics, she called such, and accounted them a downright liability in any army, jumpy and apt to run from the first danger. Such beliefs, though in fact they appeared to be borne out in the opening days of the conflict, were mostly prejudices and as such might be discounted by an opponent. There were other considerations, more likely to appeal to a professional soldier such as Sherman. Strategically, the South would fight a defensive war, and to her, accordingly, would proceed all the advantages of the defensive. Advantages which had been increasing in ratio to the improvement of modern weapons, until now it was believed and taught that the attacking force on any given field should outnumber the defenders in a proportion of at least 2 to 1. 3 to 1, some authorities insisted. When the defenders had had time to prepare, which surely would be the case in the matter at hand. A study of the map would show additional difficulties for the North, particularly in the theater lying between the two capitals, where the rivers ran east and west across the line of march, presenting a series of obstacles to the invader. In the west it would be otherwise. There the rivers ran north and south for the most part, broad highways for invasion, but few were looking westward in those days. The northern objective, announced early in the war by the man who would be her leading general, was unconditional surrender. Against this stern demand, southern soldiers would fight in defense of their homes, with all the fervor and desperation accompanying such a position. The contrast, of course, would be as true on the home front as in the armies, together with the additional knowledge on both sides that the North could stop fighting at any time, with no loss of independence or personal liberty. Whereas the South would lose not only her national existence, but would have to submit, in the course of peace, to to any terms the victor might exact under a government that would interpret and even rewrite the Constitution in whatever manner seemed most to its advantage. Under such conditions, given the American pride and the American love of liberty and self-government, it seemed certain that the South would fight with all her strength. Whether the North, driven by no such necessities, would exert herself to a similar extent in a war of conquest, remained to be seen. All this, or something like it, must have occurred to Sherman in the months after he left Louisiana for Washington, where he heard Lincoln say with a shrug, "Oh, well, I guess we'll manage to keep house." So far had he revised his opinion since that Christmas Eve in his rooms with Professor Boyd, that before the new year was out he informed the Secretary of War that 200,000 troops would be required to put down the rebellion in the Mississippi Valley alone. And it must have gone to convince him even further of a lack of Northern awareness and determination when, under suspicion of insanity, he was removed from command of troops for this remark. On the eve of the great battle for which both North and South were now preparing, Lincoln declared in his July message to Congress, "So large an army as the government now has on foot was never before known, without a soldier in it but who has taken his place there of his own free choice. But more than this, there are many single regiments whose members, one and another, possess full practical knowledge of all the arts, sciences, professions, and whatever else, whether useful or elegant, is known to the world. And there is scarcely one from which there could not be selected a president, a cabinet, a congress, and perhaps a court, abundantly competent to administer the government itself. Nor do I say this is not true also in the army of our late friends, now adversaries in this contest." This estimate of the American volunteer, though pleasant to contemplate before the shock of battle, was discovered to be far beyond the mark, North and South, especially by drill instructors charged with teaching him the manual of arms and parade ground evolutions of the line, in the course of which it often appeared that, far from being the paragon Lincoln discerned, he did not know his left foot from his right, nor his backside from his front. He took cold easily, filling the nighttime barracks and tent camps with the racking uproar of his coughs. He was short-winded and queasy in the stomach, littering the roadsides in the course of conditioning marches, like so many corpses scattered along the way. What was worse, he showed a surprising bewilderment in learning to handle his rifle. Yet these were but the shortcomings of recruits throughout the world and down the ages, back to the time of the crossbow and the spear. New problems were encountered, peculiar to the two opposing armies. The soldiers of a northern outfit, sleeping for the first time in the open, had their democratic sensibilities offended when their officers rolled themselves in their blankets a few paces apart from the line of enlisted men. On the other hand, accustomed as they were to instances of caste in civilian life, Southerners had no objections to such privileges of rank. The outrage was intensified, however, when a former social relationship was upset, so that an overseer or a storekeeper, say, was placed above a planter in the army hierarchy. "God damn you, I own niggers up the country," might be the reply to a distasteful order. While officers were sometimes called to account because of the tone in which they gave commands to certain high-born privates. Such problems were individual, and as such would be solved by time or cease to matter. Even at the outset it was clear to the discerning eye that the two armies were more alike than different. For all the talk of states' rights and the Union, men volunteered for much the same reasons on both sides. In search of glory or excitement, or from fear of being thought afraid, but mostly because it was the thing to do. The one characteristic they shared beyond all others was a lack of preparedness and an ignorance of what they had to face. Arming themselves with bowie knives and bullet-stopping Bibles, they somehow managed at the same time to believe that the war would be bloodless. Though it was in Boston, it might have been in New Orleans or Atlanta that a mother said earnestly to the regimental commander as the volunteers entrained for the journey south, "We look to you, Colonel Gordon, to bring all of these young men back in safety to their homes." All shared a belief that the war would be short, and some joined in haste out of fear that it would be over before they got there. Uniforms were at first a matter of personal taste or the availability of materials, resulting in the following exchange. "Who's that chap?" "Guess he's the colonel." "What sort of a way is that for a colonel to rig himself?" "Morphodite rig, I guess." "He ain't no colonel. He's one of those new brigadier generals that ain't got his uniform yet."
"Half general and half minister."
"Well, I said he was a morphodite." They were not yet cynical. The soldiers of that war earned their cynicism. They were sentimental, and their favorite songs were sad ones that answered some deep-seated need. "The dew is on the blossom," "Lorena," "Aurelie," "The girl I left behind me," and the tender "Home Sweet Home." Yet they kept a biting sense of the ridiculous, which they directed against anything pompous. Northern troops, for example, could poke fun at their favorite battle hymn. "Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go, shouting the battle cry of freedom." Some of their other marching songs were briefer, more sardonic, pretending to a roughness which they had not yet acquired. "Saw my leg off, saw my leg off, saw my leg off, short." Confederates hardly needed to parody their favorite Dixie. The verses were already rollicksome enough. "Old Mrs. Mary Will de Weaver, William was a gay deceiver. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland. But when he put his arm around her, he smiled as fierce as a 40-pounder. Look away, look away, look away, Dixieland." Northern troops, however, had a stanza of their own for the Southern tune. "I wish I was in St. Law County, 2 years up and I had my bounty. Away, look away, Dixieland." Southern soldiers objected to such onerous details as guard duty. They had joined the army to fight Yankees, not walk a post and miss their sleep. Similarly, Northerners were glad of a chance to move against the rebels, yet on practice marches they claimed the right to break ranks for berry picking along the roadside. At this time, there was no agreement in either army as to what the war was about, though on both sides there was a general feeling that each was meeting some sort of challenge flung out by the other. They were rather in the position of two men who, having reached that stage of an argument where one has said to the other, "Step outside," find that the subject of dispute has faded into the background while they concern themselves with the actual fight at hand. Perhaps the best definition of the conflict was given in conversation by a civilian, James M. Mason of Virginia. "I look upon it then, sir, as a war of sentiment and opinion by one form of society against another form of society." No soldier would have argued with this, but few would have found it satisfactory. They wanted something more immediate and less comprehensive. The formulation of some such definition and identification became the problem of opposing statesmen. Meanwhile, perhaps no soldier in either army gave a better answer, one more readily understandable to his fellow soldiers, at any rate, than a ragged Virginia private, pounced on by the Northerners in a retreat. "What are you fighting for, anyhow?" his captors asked, looking at him. They were genuinely puzzled, for he obviously owned no slaves and seemingly could have little interest in states' rights or even independence. "I'm fighting because you're down here," he said. Chief among the statesmen seeking a more complex definition men could carry into battle were the two leaders, Davis in Richmond and Lincoln in Washington. At the outset, it was the former who had the advantage in this respect, for in the Southern mind, the present contest was a second American Revolution, fought for principles no less high, against a tyranny no less harsh. In the Confederate capital stood the white-framed church where Patrick Henry had said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And 85 years later, another Virginian, Colonel T.J. Jackson, commanding at Harper's Ferry, could voice the same thought no less nobly. "What is life without honor? Degradation is worse than death. We must think of the living and of those who are to come after us, and see that by God's blessing we transmit to them the freedom we have ourselves inherited." The choice, then, lay between honor and degradation. There could be no middle ground. Southerners saw themselves as the guardians of the American tradition, which included the right to revolt, and therefore they launched a conservative revolution. Davis, in his inaugural, had said, "Our present condition illustrates the American idea that government rests upon the consent of the governed. The declared purpose of the Compact of Union from which we have withdrawn was to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and posterity. And when, in the judgment of the sovereign states now composing this confederacy, it had been perverted from the purposes for which it was established, a peaceful appeal to the ballot box declared that, so far as they were concerned, the government created by that compact should cease to exist." For him, as for most Southerners, even those who deplored the war that was now upon them, there was no question of seeing the other side of the proposition. There was no other side. Mrs. Davis had defined this outlook long ago. "If anyone disagrees with Mr. Davis, he resents it and ascribes the difference to the perversity of his opponent." Afterwards, in Richmond, he repeated, "All we ask is to be let alone," a remark which the Virginia private was to translate into combat terms when he told his captors, "I'm fighting because you're down here." Davis knew as well as Lincoln that after the balance sheet was struck, after the advantages of the preponderance of manpower and materiel had been weighed against the advantages of the strategical defensive, what would decide the contest was the people's will to resist, on the home front as well as on the field of battle. Time after time he declared that the outcome could not be in doubt. Yet now, as he walked the Capitol streets to and from the Spotswood and his office, or rode out to the training camps that ringed the seven-hilled city, though his step was lithe on the pavement and his figure erect in the saddle, he was showing the effects of months of strain. Men looked at him and wondered. They had been of various minds about him all along, both North and South. Back at the outset, when he first was summoned to Montgomery, while the far north Bangor Democrat was calling him one of the very, very few gigantic minds which adorn the pages of history, old General Winfield Scott, commander-in-chief of all the Union armies, received the news of Davis's election with words of an entirely different nature. Perhaps recalling their squabble over a mileage report, Scott declared, "I am amazed that any man of judgment should hope for the success of any cause in which Jefferson Davis is a leader. There is contamination in his touch." Lincoln, too, was careworn. A reporter who had known him during the Prairie years, visiting the White House now, found the same fund of humorous anecdote, but not the old free lingering laugh. His face was seamed, eroded by responsibilities and disappointments, fast becoming the ambiguous tragedy mask of the Brady photographs. Loving the Union with what amounted in his own mind to a religious mysticism, he had overrated that feeling in the South. Sumter had cost him more than he had been prepared to pay for uniting the North. Through these months, his main concern had been to avoid offending any faction. "My policy is to have no policy," he told his secretary, with the result that he offended all. Yet this was behind him now. Sumter, at least, had gained him that, and this, perhaps, was the greatest gain of all. He was free to evolve and follow a policy at last. Unlike Davis, in doing this he not only did not find a course of action already laid out for him, with his only task being one of giving it the eloquence of words and the dignity of a firm example, he could not even follow a logical development of his own beliefs as he had announced them in the past, but must, in fact, reverse himself on certain tenets which he had expressed in words that returned to plague him now and in the years to come. At the time of the Mexican War he had spoken plainly for all to hear. "Any people anywhere being inclined and having the power have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right. A right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. Nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people that can may revolutionize and make their own so much of the territory as they inhabit. He must raise before he could build, and this he was willing to do. Presently, some among those who had criticized him for doing nothing began to wail that he did too much, and with good and relevant cause, for now that the issue was unalterably one of arms, Lincoln took unto himself powers far beyond any ever claimed by a chief executive. In late April, for security reasons, he authorized simultaneous raids on every telegraph office in the northern states, seizing the originals and copies of all telegrams sent or received during the past year. As a result of this and other measures, sometimes on no stronger evidence than the suspicions of an informer nursing a grudge, men were taken from their homes in the dead of night, thrown into dungeons, and held without explanation or communication with the outside world. Writs of habeas corpus were denied, including those issued by the Supreme Court of the United States. By the same authority, or in the absence of it, he took millions from the Treasury and handed them to private individuals, instructing them to act as purchasing agents for procuring the implements of war at home and abroad. In early May, following the call for 75,000 militiamen, still without congressional sanction, he issued a proclamation increasing the regular army by more than 20,000, the navy by 18,000, and authorizing 42,034 three-year volunteers. On Independence Day, when Congress at last convened upon his call, he explained such extraordinary steps in his message to that body. "It became necessary for me to choose whether I should let the government fall into ruin, or whether, availing myself of the broader powers conferred by the Constitution in cases of insurrection, I would make an effort to save it." Congress bowed its head and agreed, though Americans grew pale in prison cells without knowing the charges under which they had been snatched from their homes or places of employment. There were guilty men among the innocent, and a dungeon was as good a place as any for a patriot to serve his country through a time of strain. Meanwhile, the arsenals were being stocked and the ranks of the armed forces were being filled. By July 6th, within 3 months of the first shot fired in anger, the Secretary of War could report that 64 volunteer regiments of 900 men each, together with 1,200 regulars, were in readiness around Washington. These 60,000, composing not one-fourth of the men then under arms in the North, were prepared to march in all their might against the cockpit of the rebellion whenever the Commander-in-Chief saw fit to order the advance. For Lincoln, as for our late friends, now adversaries, to the South, this was a second American Revolution, but by a different interpretation. The first had been fought to free the New World from the drag of Europe, and now, on the verge of her greatest expansion, the drag was being applied again, necessitating a second. The revolution, having been extended, must be secured once more by arms against those who would retard and roll it back. This was a war for democracy, for popular government, not only in a national but also in a universal sense. In that same Europe, though France had sold her revolutionary birthright, first for the starry glitter of one Napoleon, and again for the bourgeois security of a second, other nations were striving toward the freedom goal, and as they strove, they looked across the water. Here the birthright had not been sold, nor the experiment discontinued. Here the struggle still went on, until now it faced the greatest test of all. Lincoln saw his country as the keeper of a trust. On July 4th, he said to Congress, "This is essentially a people's war. On the side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of man, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Our popular government has often been called an experiment. 2 points in it our people have already settled: the successful establishing and the successful administering of it. One still remains. its successful maintenance against a formidable attempt to overthrow it. It is now for them to demonstrate to the world that those who can fairly carry an election can also suppress a rebellion, that ballots are the rightful and peaceful successors of bullets, and that when ballots are fairly and constitutionally decided, there can be no successful appeal except to ballots themselves at succeeding elections. Such will be a great lesson of peace, teaching men that what they cannot take by an election, neither can they take by war, teaching all the folly of being the beginners of a war. In early May, he had said to his young secretary, "For my part, I consider the central idea pervading this struggle is the necessity that is upon us of proving that popular government is not an absurdity. We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. If we fail, it will go far to prove the incapacity of the people to govern themselves." 2 months later, addressing Congress, he developed this theme, just as he was to continue to develop it through the coming months and years, walking the White House corridors at night, speaking from balconies and rear platforms to upturned faces, or looking out over new cemeteries created by this war. The issue embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a government of the people, by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes. These days, the military news was mostly good. Lincoln could take pride in the fact that so much had been done so quickly, the armies being strengthened and trained and permanent gains already being made. From Northwest Virginia, the news was not only good, it was spectacular. Here the contest was between Ohio and Virginia, and the advantage was all with the former. The Federal Army had only to cross the Ohio and penetrate the settled river valleys, while the Confederates had to make long marches across the almost trackless Allegheny Ridges. 8,000 loyal troops against 4,000 rebels, in an area where the people wanted no part of secession. It was an ideal setting for the emergence of a national hero, and such a hero soon appeared. At 34, Major General George Brinton McClellan, commanding the Ohio Volunteers, had earned both a military and a business reputation in the 15 years since his graduation near the top of his academy class. As a distinguished Mexican War soldier, official observer of the Crimean War, designer of the McClellan saddle, superintendent of the Illinois Central, and president of the Ohio and Mississippi Railroad. In late May, directing operations from Cincinnati, he sent troops to Grafton, east of Clarksburg on the B&O, who then marched southward 30 miles against Philippi, where they surprised the Confederates with a night attack June 3rd. The Philippi Races, it was called, for the rebels were demoralized and retreated through rain and darkness to the fastness of the mountains. Then McClellan came up. "Soldiers," he announced in an address struck off on the portable printing press which was part of his camp equipment, "I have heard there was danger here. I have come to place myself at your head and share it with you. I fear now but one thing, that you will not find foemen worthy of your steel." Seeking such foemen, he pressed the attack. When the Southern commander, Brigadier General Robert S. Garnett, retreating up the Tigert Valley, divided his army to defend the passes at Rich Mountain and Laurel Hill, McClellan divided his army too. Advancing one force to hold Garnett at the latter place, he swung widely to the right with the main body, marching by way of Buckhannon against the rebel detachment on Rich Mountain. Before that place, he again divided his forces, sending Brigadier General William S. Rosecrans around by a little-used wagon trail to strike the enemy on the flank. "No prospect of a brilliant victory," he explained, "shall induce me to depart from my intention of gaining success by maneuvering rather than by fighting. I will not throw these raw men of mine into the teeth of artillery and entrenchments if it is possible to avoid it." Either way, it was brilliant. The flanking column made a rear attack and forced the surrender of the detachment, which in turn rendered Garnett's position on Laurel Hill untenable. He retreated northward and, having got the remnant of his army across Cheat River, was killed with the rearguard at Carrick's Ford, the first general officer to die in battle on either side. By mid-July, the brief but brilliant campaign, as McClellan called it in his report, was over. He telegraphed Washington, "Our success is complete and secession is killed in this country." To his troops, he issued an address beginning, "Soldiers of the Army of the West, I am more than satisfied with you." It was indeed brilliant, just as the youthful general said, and more. It was Napoleonic. The North had found an answer to the Southern Beauregard. In Lincoln's mind, this Western Virginia campaign also served to emphasize a lack of aggressiveness nearer Washington. Patterson had taken Harper's Ferry, down on the James Peninsula. Ben Butler at least had shown fight. Big Bethel was better than nothing. But McDowell, with his army of 35,000 around Washington, had demonstrated no such spirit. In late June, responding to a request, he had submitted a plan to General Scott. While Patterson held Johnston fast in the valley, McDowell proposed to move against Manassas with a force of 30,000 of all arms organized into three columns with a reserve of 10,000. Though he warned that his new regiments were exceedingly raw, and the best of them, with few exceptions, not over steady in line, he added that he believed there was every chance of success if they are well led. Thus far, nothing had come of this. The old general-in-chief did not believe in what he called a little war by piecemeal. Lincoln, however, aware that the time of the 3-month volunteers was about to expire before any more than a fraction of them had had a chance to fire a shot at anything in Gray, saw in the plan exactly what he had been seeking. At a cabinet meeting called soon afterwards, General Scott was overruled. McDowell was told to go forward as he proposed. At first he intended to move on Monday, July 8th, but problems of supply and organization delayed him until Tuesday, 8 days later, when he issued his march order to the alerted regiments. "The troops will march to the front this afternoon," it began, and included warnings. "The three following things will not be pardonable in any commander. First, to come upon a battery or breastwork without a knowledge of its position. Second, to be surprised. Third, to fall back. Advance guards with vedettes well in front and flankers and vigilance will guard against the first and second." So they set out, 50 regiments of infantry, 10 batteries of field artillery, and 1 battalion of cavalry, shuffling the hot dust of the Virginia roads. This marching column of approximately 1,450 officers and 30,000 men, the largest and finest army on the continent, was led by experienced soldiers and superbly equipped. All 5 of the division commanders and 8 of the 11 brigade commanders were regular army men, and over half of the 55 cannon were rifled. Light marching order was prescribed, and Fairfax Courthouse was the immediate march objective, 13 miles from Arlington, the point of departure. The start had been too late for the army to reach Fairfax that first day, but orders were that it would be cleared by 8 a.m. Wednesday, Centerville being the day's objective, another 9 miles down the road and within striking distance of Manassas Junction, where the Confederates were massing. Perhaps because the warning in the march order had made the leaders meticulous and over-ambush conscious, and certainly because of the inexperience of the troops, no such schedule could be kept. Accordion action in the column caused the men to have to trot to keep up, equipment clanking, or stand in the stifling heat while the dust settled. They hooted and complained and fell out from time to time for berry picking, just as they had done on practice marches. It was all the army could do to reach Fairfax Wednesday night, and at nightfall Thursday the column was just approaching Centerville, 22 miles from the starting point after 2 1/2 days on the road, stop and go, but mostly stop. Then it was found that the men did not have in their haversacks the cooked rations McDowell's order had said they must have. Friday was spent correcting this and other matters. Saturday was used up by reconnaissance, studying maps and locating approaches to and around the enemy assembled at Manassas. Beauregard thus had been presented with 2 days of grace, by which time McDowell heard a rumor that Johnston, out in the valley, had given Patterson the slip and was at hand. He took the news with what calmness he had left, forwarded it to Washington, and set about completing his battle plan. Johnston or no Johnston, the attack was scheduled for first light Sunday morning. Lincoln in Washington and Davis in Richmond, 100 miles apart, now were exposed for the first time to the ordeal of waiting for news of the outcome of a battle in progress between the two capitals. The Northern president took it best. When McDowell had asked for a little more time for training, Lincoln told him, "You are green, it is true, but they are green also. You are all green alike." Now that the armies were arrayed and the guns were speaking, Lincoln kept this calmness. The Sunday morning news was reassuring. Even old General Scott saw victory in the telegrams from Virginia. Lincoln attended church, came back for lunch, and more exultant telegrams, and went for a carriage drive in the late afternoon, believing the battle won. Davis, being more in the dark, experienced more alarm. Beauregard's wire on the 17th had told him, "The enemy has assailed my outposts in heavy force. I have fallen back on the line of Bull Run and will make a stand at Mitchell's Ford." He spoke of retiring farther, possibly all the way to the Rappahannock, and closed with a plea for reinforcements for his 29 regiments and 29 guns, only 9 of which were rifled. Davis sent what he could, including 3 regiments and a battery from Fredericksburg, and directed Johnston to move his army to Manassas, if practicable. Johnston's 18 regiments and 20 smoothbore guns, even if they all arrived in time, would not bring Beauregard up to the reported strength of the Federals, for of the 50 regiments thus assembled to meet the 50 of the enemy, 1,700 of the Valley soldiers, the equivalent of 2 regiments, were down with the measles. Presently, however, it seemed not to matter or to be no more than a lost academic possibility. For that same Wednesday afternoon in Richmond, another telegram arrived from Beauregard. "I believe this proposed movement of General Johnston is too late. Enemy will attack me in force tomorrow morning." Thursday came and passed, and there was no attack. Then Friday came, and still the wire brought no word of battle. Davis kept busy, forwarding every corporal's guard he could lay hands on. At noon Saturday, Johnston reached Manassas with the van of his army, the rest coming along behind as fast as the overworked railroad could transport them. Sunday came, and Davis, a soldier himself, could wait no longer. He took a special northbound train. In mid-afternoon, as it neared the junction, there were so many signs of a defeat that the conductor would not permit the train to proceed, fearing it would be captured. But Davis was determined to go on. The engine was uncoupled, and the president mounted the cab, riding toward the boom of guns and now the clatter of musketry. Beyond the junction, he secured a horse and continued north. Fugitives streamed around and past him, the wounded and the ones who had lost nerve. "Go back," he told them. "Do your duty, and you can save the day." Most of the powder-grimed men did not bother to answer the tall, clean civilian riding into the smoky uproar they had just come out of. Others shouted warnings of disaster. The battle had been lost, they cried. The army had been routed. Davis rode on toward the front. Chapter 2. First Blood, New Conceptions. Irvin McDowell had come a long way since he said to Sherman on the White House steps in April, "You should have asked for a brigadier general's rank. You're just as fit for it as I am." Now, perhaps not even Sherman, still a colonel, commanding a brigade in his fellow Ohioan's army, would have replied as he did then. A West Pointer, in his early 40s, he and Beauregard had been classmates. McDowell was 6 feet tall and heavy-set, with dark brown hair and a grizzled beard worn in the French style. He had attended military school in France and later spent a year's leave of absence there, so that in addition to wearing a distinctive beard, he was one of the few regular army officers with a first-hand knowledge of the classical tactics texts, mostly French. His manner was modest and friendly in the main, but this was marred from time to time by a tendency to be impulsive and dogmatic in conversation, which offended many people. Some were appalled as well by his gargantuan appetite, one witness telling how he watched in dismay while McDowell, after a full meal, polished off a whole watermelon for dessert and pronounced it monstrous fine. He had a strong will along certain lines, as for instance in his belief that alcohol was an evil. Once when his horse fell on him and knocked him out, the surgeon who tried to administer some brandy found his teeth so firmly clamped that they could not be pried apart, and McDowell was proud that even unconscious he would not take liquor. Now, indeed, marching at the head of an army whose fitness for testing under fire he himself had doubted, he had need to clamp his teeth still tighter and call on all his self-control. Since setting out, prodded into motion by a civilian president who discounted the unpreparedness by remarking that the men of both armies were green alike, which did not at all take into account that one of them, McDowell's, would be required to execute a tactical march in the presence of the enemy, he had watched his fears come true. While congressmen and other members of Washington society, some of them accompanied by ladies with picnic hampers, harried the column with buggies and gigs, the troops went along with the lark, lending the march the holiday air of an outing. They not only broke ranks for berry picking, they discarded their packs and spare equipment, including their cumbersome cartridge boxes, and ate up the rations intended to carry them through the fighting. Reissuing ammunition and food had cost him a day of valuable time in addition to the one already lost in wretched marching. And now, as he spent another day with his army brought up short at Centerville while he explored the roads and fords leading down to and across Bull Run, where the rebels were improving their position, the worst of his fears was rumored to be fact. Johnston had reached Manassas, leaving Patterson holding the bag out in the valley. As he rose before daylight Sunday morning, having completed his reconnaissance, issued the orders for attack, and eaten his usual oversized supper the night before, it was no wonder he was experiencing the discomfort of an upset digestion. Even McDowell's iron stomach had gone back on him, cramping his midriff with twinges of pain and tightening the tension on his nerves. Despite the twinges as he waited for the roar of guns to announce that the attack was rolling, there was confidence in his bearing. He felt that his tactical plan, based as it was on careful preparations, was a sound one. A study of the map had shown a battlefield resembling a spraddled X. Bull Run flowed from the northwest to the southeast to form one cross member. Warrenton Turnpike ran arrow straight, southwest-northeast, to form the other. The stream was steep-banked, dominated by high ground and difficult to cross except at fords above and below a stone bridge spanning the run where the turnpike intersected it. McDowell had planned to attack on the left, that flank affording the best approach to Richmond. But when reconnaissance showed that the fords below the bridge were strongly held by rebel infantry and artillery, he looked to his right. Upstream, out the western arm of the X, he found what he was seeking. Cavalry patrols reported good crossings lightly held in that direction, one at Sudley Springs, all the way out the western arm, and another about halfway out. Both were suitable for wheeled vehicles, the troopers reported, which meant that the main effort, launched by way of these two crossings, could be supported by the superior federal artillery. Now McDowell had his attack plan, and he committed it to paper. Of his four divisions, each with about 8,000 men, two would demonstrate against the run, while the other two executed a turning movement against the Confederate left flank. The 1st Division, under Brigadier General Daniel Tyler, would move toward the Stone Bridge to feint the main attack upon this point. The 4th Division, under Colonel D.S. Miles, would be held in reserve near Centerville at the tip of the eastern arm of the X, but one of its brigades would make a false attack on Blackburn's Ford, halfway down the eastern leg and midway between Centerville and Manassas. As the 2nd and 3rd Divisions, under Colonels David Hunter and S.P. Heintzelman, having made their turning movement and launched their attack, swept down the south bank of the stream, crumpling the Confederate line of battle, they would uncover the bridge and the fords, permitting the 1st and 4th Divisions to cross the run and strengthen the main effort with fresh troops. This time there were no admonitions as to what would not be pardonable. The troops were to drive right through with more of savagery than caution. Richmond lay beyond the roll of the southern horizon. Sound as the plan was, it was also complicated, involving two feints by half the army and a flank attack by the other half, with the main effort to be made at right angles to the line of advance. McDowell knew that much depended on soldierly obedience to orders. Yet his commanders were regulars, and despite their clumsy performance on the long march, he felt that he could count on them for a short one. As a professional soldier, he also knew that much would depend on luck, good and bad, but in this connection all he could do was hope for the former and guard against the latter. For one thing, to forestall delay, he could order an early start, and this he did. The holding divisions were to leave their camps by 3 a.m. to open the demonstrations at Stone Bridge and Blackburn's Ford, while the turning column was to set out even earlier, at 2 o'clock, in order to clear Sudley Springs by 7 at the latest. And so it was. The troops lurched into motion on schedule, some having had but very little sleep, others having had no sleep at all. And now again it was stop and go, but mostly stop, just as on the other march. Except that now there was the added confusion of darkness and bone-deep weariness as they stumbled over logs and roots, and were stabbed at by branches in the woods, clanking as they ran to catch up, or stood stock still to breathe the thick dust of the sacred soil. About 9:30, 2.5 hours behind schedule, the head of the column reached Sudley Springs, where the men were halted to rest and drink. Away downstream, opposite the Stone Bridge and the ford, the guns of the other two divisions had been booming with false aggressiveness for more than 3 hours now. Beauregard at Manassas, midway between the straddled feet of the X, had no intention of awaiting his classmates' pleasure. When Johnston had joined him Saturday with about half of his 9,000 men, the rest being due to arrive in the night, the Creole general's spirits rose. Now that his army was about to be almost equal to the enemy's, he would attack. He made his dispositions accordingly, concentrating his regiments along the eastern leg of the X, from Stone Bridge down to Union Mills Ford, where the crossing would be made in force to envelop the Federal left and crush it while he marched on Centerville. Thus Beauregard and McDowell, on opposite sides of Bull Run, had more or less identical plans, each intending to execute a turning movement by the right flank to strike his opponent's left. If both had moved according to plan, the two armies might have grappled and spun round and round like a pair of dancers clutching each other and twirling to the accompaniment of cannon. However, this could only happen if both moved on schedule. And late as McDowell was, Beauregard was later. In the first place, there was trouble on the railroad from Manassas Gap, and though some of Johnston's men had been assigned a share in the forward movement, the remainder of them did not arrive that night. In the second place, the attack order was ambiguous and vague. There was to be an advance across the run, then an advance on Centerville, and though each section of the plan ended, "The order to advance will be given by the commander-in-chief," it was not clear to the brigade commanders just which advance was meant. They took it to mean the advance on the crossing, whereas Beauregard intended it to mean the second advance, after the crossing had been forced. Accordingly, early Sunday morning at Manassas, while Beauregard listened for the roar of guns, there was only silence from the right. Then there arrived from Mitchell's Ford, 2 miles below Stone Bridge, a messenger who reported that the enemy had appeared in strength to the left front of that position. And as if to reinforce this information, there came a sound of firing from the vicinity of the bridge. To guard against a crossing, Beauregard sent his reserve brigades under Brigadier Generals Barnard B. and T.J. Jackson to strengthen the few troops he had stationed there on the left flank of his army. All this time, he listened for the boom of cannon to indicate that his attack was underway on the right. From that direction, all he heard was silence. But northward, from the direction of the bridge, the cannonade was swelling to a roar. At 8 o'clock, Beauregard left his office at Manassas Junction to establish field headquarters on Lookout Hill, in the rear of Mitchell's Ford. From there, of course, the roar of guns was louder, coming from both the left and right, Stone Bridge and Blackburn's Ford, but still there were no signs of an advance across the run. By 9 o'clock, Beauregard had begun to suspect that the Federal main body was elsewhere, probably on one of his flanks, preparing to surprise him. Just then, as if in substantiation of his fears, a message arrived from a signal officer. "I see a body of troops crossing Bull Run about 2 miles above the Stone Bridge. The head of the column is in the woods on this side. The rear of the column is in the woods on the other side. About a half mile of its length is visible in the open ground between. I can see both infantry and artillery." Beauregard reacted fast. While a dust cloud floated up from that direction to show the enemy in force, he sent couriers after B. and Jackson, instructing them to march above the bridge, and ordered Colonel Wade Hampton, just arrived from Richmond with 600 South Carolinians, also to proceed to the exposed flank. When these commands joined the brigade of Colonel N.G. Evans, already posted near the bridge, he would have about 6,500 men on the left, barely one-fourth of his army. Still, in spite of a rumor that the mystery column raising its ominous dust cloud might be Patterson, arrived from the valley with 30,000 men, Beauregard was hoping that somehow the long-overdue attack on the enemy left might have smashed through for a counterstroke. Then a message arrived from Brigadier General R.S. Ewell at Union Mills Ford. He had waited all this time for orders. Now he was going forward without them. Beauregard despaired. This late, the attack could do no good. It would serve only to make those troops unavailable to help stem whatever success the enemy might achieve on the left. With his army so scattered, it hardly seemed possible to organize any sort of effective resistance. "My heart for a moment failed me," he said later. Johnston was also there on Lookout Hill, the ranking Confederate, though so far he had left the dispositions in Beauregard's hands, being himself unfamiliar with the terrain. He watched with increasing concern as things went from bad to worse, the dust cloud spreading on the left while Beauregard did what he could to meet the challenge, recalling from across the run the brigades of Ewell, D.R. Jones, and James Longstreet. By 11 o'clock, the fury beyond Stone Bridge was approaching crescendo. The tearing clatter of musketry swelled the uproar of the guns, and powder smoke boiled up dead white out of the dust. Johnston, chafing under his self-imposed inaction, at last could bear it no longer. "The battle is there," he told Beauregard. "I am going." And he went. Beauregard was not far behind him. Remaining only long enough to order Brigadier General T.H. Holmes and Colonel Jubal Early to march their brigades to the left, he overtook Johnston soon after noon, the Virginian having paused to send a couple of unemployed batteries into action, and the two went on together, accompanied by their staffs. They rode past wounded and frightened men, dazed and blood-stained stragglers from the fight which they could hear but could not see until, climbing a wooded hill, they reached the crest at about 12:30, to find the battle raging below them, a panorama of jetting smoke and furious movement. A few gray regiments were in action, their muskets flashing pink in the swirl of smoke. Others, shattered by the blue onslaught, were streaming for the rear. Across the line of their retreat, a fresh Confederate brigade stood just behind a crest of a ridge adjoining the hill the generals watched from. Their ranks aligned steadily on both sides of a battery whose 6 guns were firing rapidly into the advancing mass of Federals. These troops had the determined, steadfast appearance of veterans. Otherwise, the field had a look of impending disaster. McDowell at last had got his flanking divisions over the run at Sudley Springs, doubling the column to speed the crossing. It was smartly done, the blue ranks closely packed, water squelching in their shoes after their splash across the creek. But as they emerged from the woods about a mile south of the ford, Colonel Ambrose Burnside's Rhode Islanders heading the advance, they ran into fire from 2 Confederate regiments drawn up to meet them with 2 smoothbore 6-pounders barking aggressively on the flank. These were South Carolinians and Louisianians. Their commander, Colonel Evans, charged with defending the stone bridge, had soon determined that the cannonade there was no more than a feint. Evans, called Shanks because of the thinness of his legs, was an old line soldier, resentful at having been stationed far to the left of where the main effort was intended. When he observed the dust cloud to the northwest, beyond the flank of the army, he saw his opportunity and acted on his own initiative. Leaving a handful to guard the bridge, he marched his 1,000 men upstream to block the path of 13,000 Federals. The meeting engagement was sudden and furious, the gray troops having the advantage of firing the first volley. As they were beginning to come apart under pressure, they were joined by